Good to see you this morning. We are today in Ecclesiastes chapter 5. I'm kind of in this extended section here, this longer section. Starts in chapter 5 and includes most of 5 and into 6, most of chapter 6. And at first glance, when I first got the section and saw that it was broken up this way, I was at first shocked. I didn't really understand why, but as we'll see in a minute, it's laid out in a good way. Solomon does something really poetic. He leans it out in a really cool poetic way here. So the other week, Sarah and I were on vacation, and I had a moment. We were at Leanne's house in Leanne Stiles, and she has like every John Grisham novel known to man around her house, and we just had some extra time sitting around waiting, so I looked and I saw this John Grisham novel called The Testament. Some of you may have read it, but it's a story of a guy who's at the end of his life. He made a lot of money. I had a moment just to get through chapter one, so I don't know. I haven't read the book. I just read chapter one, so. And what I read, so interestingly enough, what I read in chapter 1 was this, which is very fitting with where we are today. It's this guy at the end of his life that made more money than he knew what to do with, billionaire. His body's wasting away. He's in a wheelchair. He's been married 3 times. He has multiple children from all 3 marriages. And the scene is set up in chapter 1 where he's sitting at the top of his penthouse, this building that he owns, and on the floors underneath him, three different levels are the families, the ex-wives and their children that are sitting there waiting for his new will and testament to come out. So he's redoing his will. And so they're ready, you know, what are we going to get? And there's this part where Grisham writes this, the guy speaking, sitting in his wheelchair at the top of the penthouse of this building, and he says this. He says, as I sit here in my wheelchair, alone and waiting, I cannot think of a single thing I want to buy or see or a single place I want to go or another adventure I want to pursue. I've done it all, and I'm very tired. The money is the root of my misery. I am really ready for the hereafter. It has to be better than this. So some of you may have heard this recent quote, kind of similar. We'll stick with this theme for a moment. DeMar DeRozan, I don't know if anybody's clicked on like ESPN.com or the ESPN app lately. It seems like there's a lot being talked about mental health in the NBA. And DeMar DeRozan was quoted saying this recently when asked about his anxiety and struggles with anxiety and depression. And DeMar DeRozan is an NBA basketball player, for those who don't know. But he said this. He said, people say, what are you depressed about? You can buy anything you want. And he said, I wish everyone in the world was rich so they would realize money isn't everything. Isn't that crazy? Americans spend $70 billion every year on the lottery. $70 billion a year on the lottery for a 1 in 175 million chance. 1 in 175 million chance to win, to get more money. See, throughout history, the accumulation of wealth, it's not just American, it's not just our culture, though it's rampant in our culture. Throughout history, the accumulation of wealth and riches has been a very common theme. People want to get rich. And when Solomon was on this experimental journey here, that produced the book of Ecclesiastes, riches were all around. Wealth was all around. He was, you know, had the Israel, the people of God here, and they had the Assyrians over here and the Egyptians down here, and these two massive kingdoms, just there was money and riches all around. But it wasn't just the surrounding kingdoms, it was God's people as well. Israel was doing well. There was wealth, there was riches within the people of Israel. And Solomon writes this section as a warning for God's people against the pursuit of riches and to encourage them towards the enjoyment of God and his good gifts, his daily gifts. And since this book is broken down, and it's a poetic book, and here's why this section, this is really cool, why this section is put together from chapter 5, verse 8 to chapter 6, verse 9. Jeff, you want to throw that slide up. It's called a chiasm or a chiactic structure. It's poetic structure, literary structure, right? That's like a step. He takes steps. So you have point A, and then you have point B, and then he has a climax, and then you have point B2, and then point A2. So it's almost he steps up to the climax, and he steps back down to reiterate his points. And so we see that this is how this is set up. And it climaxes in verse 20. The end of chapter 5 is the center of all of this. So we're going to start in verse 8. Ecclesiastes 5, verse 8, he says, "If you see in a province the oppression of the poor and the violation of justice and righteousness, don't be amazed at the matter. For the high official is watched by a higher, and there are yet higher ones over them. But this is gain for land in every way, a king committed to cultivated fields." I'm not going to try to interpret that last section there, or that last word, verse. But what he starts out with in verse 8, he starts out with the poor. This message about the poor and poverty and the oppressed and the afflicted. Right? It says, when we look out at life under the sun, is the way he's been wording this, right? When we look out at life under the sun, he says, you know what? You're going to see oppression. You're going to see injustice. It's going to be there. It's all around. And I know for us here in suburbia, we kind of guard and shield ourselves against that. We don't see it as much in Kingwood. We don't see poverty. We don't see oppression and injustice a whole lot here. But if you drive up the road a few minutes or down the road a few minutes, it's not far from us. It's here. It's around. And Solomon says, when you see it, because you will, when you see it, don't be amazed. Don't be amazed. Don't marvel at it as if it's unexpected or as if it shouldn't be. See, evil abounds, and the experience of loss and injustice is not unique, and none of us in here, nor those close to us, is immune to it. None of us. He's saying this is. But what we see is because of the amazement, right? He says don't be amazed, but because of the amazement, when we see poverty, when we see injustice, when we see these things and we're shocked by it, or maybe even our own lives, we experience poverty and injustice, we become shocked by it. We're amazed. The language that he uses there, we usually have this pendulum swing, right? It's like, this is so shocking and so amazing, we swing the pendulum to the opposite side. And you know what? We're not going to let that happen. We don't want that to happen. We want to get out of that. And so it's the whole rags to riches story, right? Our answer to cure this injustice is wealth, money, riches. Let's swing the pendulum. So that's what being amazed by it or the shock value usually does. See, poverty and oppression, that's why he starts out with this, is because it speaks to lack, right? Or missing out on something. We're missing something. There's a lack. And lack speaks to dissatisfaction. Dissatisfaction can be mixed in with discontentment. Discontentment also can be interpreted as there's an injustice in the midst of that. And what I mean by that is injustice speaks to things not being right, right? There's something wrong here. It's not right. There's injustice. So what we see is it's not right to be without. There's an injustice, the discontentment, the dissatisfaction. Something's not right. We need to have. So that's that cycle. We turn to money. We turn to riches, we turn to wealth to get out of that poverty. And in our culture, it can be taken on as like this sheer determination of will, right? Maybe we've been poor and we're never going to be poor again, or we see the poor and we're going to do everything in our power to not be poor, right? Sheer determination. We're not going to let that happen. Anybody remember the Scarlett O'Hara in Gone with the Wind? The great, great quote, she says, "I'm going to live through this, and when it's all over, I'll never be hungry again. No, nor my folk. If I have to lie, steal, cheat, or kill, as God is my witness, I'll never be hungry again. Right? Sheer determination of will. I will not let that happen. And that's what the teacher here, Solomon, is seeking to warn God's people about. See, these things, the pursuits may start off as honorable or noble. You know, getting out of poverty, helping the oppressed, that's honorable, that's noble. But when it becomes the love, affection of our life, it can lead us off track. He wants to warn us against this. See verse 10. He says, he who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. This also is vanity. This is Solomon's first point here. A people who love and pursue wealth will never be satisfied. That first step in this structure. A people who love and pursue wealth will never be satisfied. See, possessions and wealth, I want to clarify for us, are not bad. It's not bad in and of themselves. He's not saying it's bad to get out of poverty. He's not saying, hey, everybody that believes in God needs to just be impoverished. He's not saying that. He's not saying it's bad to work hard, to make a good living. He's not saying it's bad to pay your bills, to buy a house, to buy a car, to buy a boat, to buy new kicks, to buy some new clothes, to buy some stuff for your toys for your kids. If you can afford it, if it's within your means, he's saying it's not bad to do those things. What he is saying is that it's bad to love and devote the course of your life towards those things. It's bad to love riches. The evil lies in the affection and the pursuit, not in the possession of. Does that make sense? We love them. In his church, in a sense, riches and wealth to find that peace and that rest. We love them enough. And he's saying that's where it's off. And he mirrors this point, the other step in this poetry here in Ecclesiastes in 6, 7 through 9. Chapter 6, it says, and the toil of man is for his mouth, yet his appetite is not satisfied. For what advantage has the wise man over the fool, and what does the poor man have who knows how to conduct himself before the living? Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the appetite. This also is vanity and a chasing after the wind. See, toiling to get food and to be satisfied is an endless and unsatisfactory endeavor. We get and then it goes away. We eat, right? And then we wake up and we're hungry again. Our appetites are like a bottomless pit. We search for more. We desire more. We can't just get enough. And he says it's actually better to just have what's before you, your eyes. What is before your eyes? Rather than constantly pursuing something else to be satisfied, what's right before your eyes? Be content with the possessions that you have at the moment. That's better than having a roaming and wandering up and down, anxious toil of an appetite, searching and longing for something else. That's the pendulum swing, right? We see poverty, we see the oppression, we see these things that fear and shock sets in, and we swing our pendulum to the grass is greener mentality. A wandering heart. Man, I don't want that, so I'm going to go search for these things to satisfy me. Job, stuff, places, relationships, status, recognition. It's like our desires are never content at staying home. As one scholar put it, they're always traveling but never arriving. Just searching. And he says it's better just what's right before you. Quit looking out there. Look right here. Look what God has given you. And we see this in Isaiah 53:6. He says, we all like sheep have gone astray. Right? We've turned every one of us to our own way. We've wandered. right? In Jeremiah 14:10, it says, this is what the Lord says concerning these people. Truly, they love to wander. They never rest their feet. That appetite searching throughout life. The hymn writer in the Come Thou Fount, he says, I'm prone to wander. Lord, I feel it. I'm prone to leave the God I love. See, our desires, they wander and they pursue rest, but they can't find it. We look for that satisfaction and that fulfillment, and we look for money, more money, more money. If we can get more money, if we can get that money, we're gonna be there. See, the enemy uses circumstances and poverty and oppression in this world and like the flashiness of the world to disguise, to hide God from us, to hide what truly satisfies from us. We see the poverty, we see the flashiness, and we think, man, if there's more money, we can get that. It'll be good. I mean, it hides what truly satisfies. Look at 1 Timothy 6:10. It says, for the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. It is though through this craving that some have wandered away from the faith. And in Matthew 13, Jesus, in talking about the parable of the sower, the seed sown among the thorns, he said the cares of the world and the deceitfulness of riches. It's a deceptiveness that wealth, this worldly wealth, seeks to provide us. So we see it, and I love this. William Tyndale, he said this. He said, if poverty has its problems, love of wealth is not an appropriate alternative. If poverty has its problems, love of wealth is not an appropriate alternative. See, the alternative to poverty and riches, why he starts out with the poor, right? The alternative to poverty is wealth and riches. And so we think the problems here in poverty will lead us to, if we can get wealth and riches, we won't have problems. But we all know the great hip-hop theologian Puff Daddy said, mo money, mo problems, right? So the reality is, more money does not give us less problems. And Puff Daddy got that from these verses, right? Solomon was a hip-hop artist before he knew it. Ecclesiastes 5, verse 11 and 12, he says, when goods increase, they increase who eat them. What advantage has their owner but to see them with his eyes? Sweet is the sleep of a laborer, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich will not let him sleep. More money means more people want your money. Increase of goods means increase of consumers. See, for those of us who are generous, we may think, this is great, more money, more people to want the money, we can give more away. That's not a big problem, but when your wealth is your satisfaction, when your money is your answer to all of your problems, then it becomes a problem when family members show up, when nonprofits show up, when the church shows up, when the government shows up. You got to pay more taxes, right? Everybody wants more piece of the pie. And when we put all of our hope and our satisfaction in this thing, we're giving away our love. We don't want to give away our love, our satisfaction. That's a problem. The more we have, the more people want it. The more people want it, the bigger the problem. And then he says, not only that, you're not going to get much sleep. Not going to get much sleep. The full stomach of the rich will not let him sleep. And we could go with, you know, a wealthy person is always thinking about how to make more wealth, or maybe thinking about where's his money and is it taken care of, and so he's kind of anxious and all of that. But he equates it to food, and he compares it to the laborer. So those with lots of money don't have to work. They don't have to labor. So what do? Just their casual lifestyle and all the rich food that they get to eat. They don't sleep well. Just don't sleep well. They don't get rest. Isn't that cool? They don't get rest. more money, more problems. So Solomon continues his poetic appeal here, takes the next step up. So the first step, right, is that we're not going to be satisfied. If you love money, you're not going to be satisfied. And then takes the next step up in these two stories. He shares these two stories, one in chapter 5, verses 13 through 17, and one in chapter 6, verses 1 through 6. And they're kind of parallel stories. The first one, and Jeff, you can go ahead and throw that Ecclesiastes 13, 14 verse up there. The first one is this man who stores up riches to the point of actually causing him harm. So he's storing his wealth up, and then it causes him harm, and then he puts it into a business venture, and it goes bad, and he loses it all. And then it says he gets to the end of his life having lost it all, and he has nothing to leave for his son. And having nothing to leave for his son, he goes away. It says he goes away empty. He leaves this earth as he arrived on the earth with nothing. Absolutely nothing. His love for riches not only harmed him, it harmed his family. It harmed those around him. The pursuit of his life, his wealth, and his riches left him with nothing but darkness, vexation, sickness, and anger, is what verse 17 says. No joy, no rest. And then you see this parallel story in chapter 6. The second man is a man who has all these wealth and possessions and honor, where it literally says he lacked nothing that he ever desired. Lacked nothing. But he was not equipped to enjoy it. Not equipped to enjoy it. So he had everything he wanted, could ever have wanted. Kind of like the guy in the Testament, John Chrisham, wrote. Had everything he wanted, but then he says this. He not only like all the stuff, possessions, and wealth. Look, it says he fathered 100 children and he lived for 2,000 years. So in that culture, this is hyperbole, right? It's poetry, so it's hyperbole, exaggeration. Guy didn't really live for 2,000 years. Though if it was Solomon, he probably really did have 100 children. But hyperbole says this guy not only had all the wealth and possessions he wanted, but in a culture that values children, in a culture that values long life, he had it all. Not only did he have everything he could ever wanted, he had children and he had long life. And this guy was not satisfied with life's good things. He literally saw no good in life. No good in life. Darkness, no rest, no joy. Which leads to Solomon's second point. The second step is a people who love and pursue wealth cannot enjoy life. A people who love and pursue wealth cannot enjoy life. And that's a grievous thing, Solomon says. It's a terrible thing to not enjoy life. To not enjoy life, Solomon says, it's evil. The lack of joy in life, enjoyment of life, is from the evil one. And the evil one wants us to pursue things that we think will bring joy in life. Right? He flashes these things, wealth and riches, in front of our eyes, and if we get these things, we will be able to enjoy life. But the enemy does not want us to enjoy life. So he throws the facade up. The promise that they'll produce enjoyment, but they don't. DeMar DeRozan, the basketball player, can buy anything he wants, and yet he says, I still am depressed and anxious. I have no joy. The last thing the enemy wants in our lives, the people of God's life, is joy. So he paints the most beautiful picture. People laughing, people having fun, people playing and enjoying life with the latest and greatest food or drink or gadget or car or house or vacation. And he puts it on every media source he can, commercials, billboards, social media, whatever. He throws it out there for us to see and say, if we just got that, that would bring joy to my life. in hopes that we would grab on and go after that thing, and that thing would satisfy us, only to realize that when we get it, it doesn't. It doesn't bring joy or enjoyment of life. 1 John 2, John says, "Don't love the world or the things in the world. If anything loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, all that is in the world, the desires of the flesh, the pride of life, the desires of the eyes, those aren't from the Father. They're from the world. The lust of the flesh, the desires of the flesh, the desires of the eyes. That's what the enemy throws up at us and says, if we get that, we'll enjoy it. But in reality, Solomon's saying, you're not going to enjoy life. Which leads him to the top, the climax, the top step. Chapter 5, verses 18 through 19, he says, "Behold," and this is such a beautiful, beautiful shining light in the midst of the surrounding darkness. It just bursts forth, he says, and I love it, bursts forth. He says, "Behold," right? "Behold, look, see what I see. I've seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil which one toils under the sun, the few days of his life that God has given him. For this is his lot. Everyone also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them." Wealth, possessions, power to enjoy them. "And accept his lot and rejoice in his toil. This is the gift of God." So this is the central theme to this entire section. It's the central theme to the entire Bible. It's the central theme essentially to all of humanity. God's story in the earth. Remember what I said earlier, why Solomon wrote this section. It was to warn God's people not to pursue riches, but to encourage them towards the enjoyment of God and his good gifts. All that we have comes from God. All of it. Our life, our families, our jobs, the food we eat, the things we drink, our wealth, our possessions, and even the ability to enjoy them comes from God. Why? To enjoy him. To experience him. To know him. To find joy in him. What does the old catechism say? The chief end of man is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. Enjoy him forever doesn't just mean eternity. We get to enjoy God for eternity, but that forever includes now. Now is part of forever. So our end, even now on this earth, is to enjoy God. And it's not just to enjoy God, as Solomon points out here, it's to enjoy the good gifts of God, to enjoy life that he has given us here under the sun, in the midst of all the chaos and the turmoil that surrounds. Regardless of where we are, and regardless of the poverty or the riches, regardless of the struggles or the non-struggles, regardless, to find enjoyment here. Paul says in Philippians 4, he says, "I'm not speaking of being in need. I've learned in whatever situation I'm to be content. I've learned what it means to have what I need and more than enough, and I learned what it means to go without and to be in poverty." Right? I've learned both. I found a contentment here of soul. And that's what accepting our lot is, that Solomon gets at, accepting his lot, that it's a transformed heart. It's a change of pursuit, affection, a heart affection that says, I now love and pursue something else than what is here seen. We no longer pursue wealth and riches in search of satisfaction and joy. We pursue God and are satisfied and are able to enjoy the good things of life. That's a beautiful grace, a beautiful gift of grace, to be able to enjoy the life we have. And what I love about this section, what I love about this section is Solomon says, It can happen. I've seen it. Notice he says, behold, what I have seen to be good. I have seen this. This is good news for us. He's seen it firsthand, that there is possible for us a life that can be satisfied in God and grateful and can experience enjoyment in all things in life. That's possible for us. Which leads us to the climax, the third point. A people who love and pursue God will be satisfied, and will find enjoyment in life's good gifts. Not could be, not hopefully will be satisfied. Will be. And this is how he puts the cherry on the top, verse 20. For he will not much remember the days of his life, because God keeps him occupied with joy in his heart. I was studying this out and reading this over and over again. I would get to that and I'd freeze. I would just sit and sit in the reality, occupied with joy in his heart. A life satisfied in God, so occupied with joy, that the vanities of life, they fade. He doesn't remember them. It's like they've blown past him. Like, what? Oh, that what? I didn't even see that. I've been preoccupied. Where? In his heart. Right? The great work of the gospel is heart work. Right? Ezekiel 11 says, I'm going to give him a new heart. I'm going to take a heart of stone and turn it into a heart of flesh. I'm going to transform their heart so that why they can understand my statutes and keep my rules and obey them. And I'll be their God and they'll be my people. Like, we're going to be one. I'm going to transform their heart. 2 Corinthians 5 says, I'm going to be a new creation. I'm going to make them holy and new. The work of the gospel shapes, transforms our hearts. And we now celebrate the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. Because it is what produces joy within our lives. A heart of stone made flesh so that we can know God and obey him and enjoy him. Solomon says that type of person is occupied with joy. The way that language there, the Hebrew word for occupied there is an activity that keeps a person physically busy and mentally preoccupied. So it's basically your work. It's your work. How many workaholics we got in here? Don't raise your hand. Mark. Workaholics, for those of you that are a workaholic and have friends that have told you this, or a spouse that is married to a workaholic will know this. When someone is consumed with work, when they're in their business, they don't think about anything else. It's like, oh, the kids did what? He won his baseball game? Oh, gosh, wish I would have been there for that, right? Preoccupied physically and mentally that things just pass by. That's the language here. Preoccupied with joy in his heart that the things of the world just pass by. It's our business, he says. Joy in God is our business. It's our work. John 6, Jesus says, I'm not going to read it. These guys are like, wait, what can we do to be doing the works of God? Because he talks about don't work for the food that doesn't last, but work towards food that endures forever, for eternal life. That's what you're to work for. And they're like, okay, yeah, tell us. All right, what do we do to be doing this work? And he says, this is the work of God, to believe in him who he has sent. Our work is faith in Christ. The preoccupation of our life, what we are consumed with, is faith and joy in God. And when we get there, we don't remember the days, right? We're the workaholic that we don't remember. Oh, I did what? It's kind of like that movie Click. You ever seen that movie Click where he just gets on autopilot and he's like, just go, 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 go. And he's like, what happened back there? That's what he's talking about here. We get so consumed with Jesus and glorifying God and enjoying God and worshiping God and adoring God and praising God and singing to God and proclaiming God. We get so consumed with it that the sorrows and the pains and the fears of life, they just pass us by. Pass us by. And I was thinking about this morning. We can say, yeah, Jeremy, but how? I don't feel it. I don't feel that joy. I don't feel preoccupied in joy. I wake up in the morning and I don't want to get up, and I'm just got to deal with traffic, and then I hit a piece of pipe on my way to work and got to get towed and all this stuff. Like, it's just crazy life, and I just don't feel it. And I come home and I'm tired and I deal with all the stuff in the house, and I don't feel it. That's when you pray. That's when you sing. That's when you worship. That's when you call upon the church. That's when you turn your heart and your mind to God. When you wake up in the morning, turn your heart and your mind to God. Be preoccupied. Those things are going to come. Pipes are still going to be in the middle of the interstate, unfortunately. Kids are still going to be kids. Spouses are still going to be spouses. Jobs are still going to be jobs. These things are still going to be at us. The cares of the world are still going to be there. So let's be a people that preoccupy our lives with God. Think about Him. Pray to Him. Sing to Him. Worship Him. Enjoy Him. Proclaim Him. Adore Him. Seek after Him. Listen to Him. It's the joy of God, the good news of Jesus, that empowers us to enable and endure all of these terrible circumstances of life. And it's the joy of God, the good news of Jesus, that really frames up the good things that we have in life. It puts them in the right place, in the proper perspective. Our wealth, our possessions, our homes, our cars, our boats, our whatever. It puts it in its proper place that we can enjoy life for God, in His glory, and take all the stuff that He's given us, because it's a gift, and we can take it and we can just use it for His glory and enjoy Him. See what Solomon gets at here? The climax is that God has entered into these evils, he says. God has entered into these evils of false satisfactions, of false hopes, of false joys. He's entered into them to keep us joyfully occupied with Himself all the days of our lives. So the main point here is that a people who love and pursue wealth will never be satisfied and cannot enjoy life. But a people who love and pursue God through faith in Jesus will find true satisfaction and will rightfully enjoy God's good gifts. Rightfully enjoy God's good gifts. He will preoccupy us with joy in our hearts. Let's pray.